So perhaps one short version of how to do this practice, or advice for how to do this practice, would be to stay close to your heart. Stay close to your heart as you go through this. Stay close to the heart qualities that you have. And even if your heart aches in some way or hurts in some way, stay close, because we have these beautiful qualities in the heart and the beautiful wisdom of the heart that knows kind of how to heal and how to process and how to wake up. And it's a phenomenal thing to stay close to the heart and let that whole world blossom for you. And the paramis, these 10 perfections that are the theme for this retreat, are 10 beautiful qualities of the heart that support us, can support us in practice, and support us in daily life. Part of the value of the paramis is they bridge both retreat practice, meditation practice, and practicing in daily life. They can be cultivated in both, and cultivating them in one place develops them and then supports you in the other place. So certainly here on the retreat, where we're focused on retreat practice, meditation practice, the paramis can be applied or are relevant for deepening or filling out our practice. And then in daily life, they're equally relevant there, and they're immensely practical for daily life, for a good life, living a good life. So these 10 paramis, I'll probably repeat the list a number of times, and maybe by the end of the retreat you'll have memorized them. And they are generosity. And the fact that it begins with generosity is not a coincidental point. So generosity, ethics or virtue, integrity, renunciation, wisdom, effort, courage, strength, then there's patience, truthfulness, determination or resolve, loving kindness or goodwill or friendliness, and equanimity. And in thinking about this and, you know, staying close to the heart, there's a wonderful simile that the Buddha gives. And it's a simile of a chicken sitting on her eggs. And the Buddha says that if a chicken sits on her eggs properly and incubates the eggs, even if a chicken thinks or, you know, don't have these eggs hatch, I don't want these eggs to hatch, the eggs will hatch. So if she provides the conditions for the incubating of the eggs, the chicks, they'll, at some point, whether she wants them to be there or not, she's providing the conditions and they will grow and hatch. And the Buddha says the same thing, that for us, if you put together the conditions for awakening, you will awaken, even if you don't want to. Isn't that great? I love it. And that partly I like it because it suggests that it doesn't have to be so absorbed in the idea of desires and what we want and what's in it for me and, you know, all these self-centered ways in which we can engage in spiritual practice. That there's a process that goes on irregardless. We don't have to want to become spiritually mature. We just create the conditions for it. And then we stay close to those conditions. We let it incubate. We support and protect those conditions so something can grow and incubate within. It's a simile that I think for me represents an organic, natural process that exists within us. And certainly, Buddhist practice can take a lot of effort, but a lot of the effort is not the effort to make something happen, but rather the effort to create the conditions that allows something to evolve and grow and mature. And that makes a big difference, those two perspectives. Because if it's up to you to huff and puff and make something happen, to huff and puff and get concentrated, it might reinforce a lot of kind of barren, what the Buddha calls the barrenness of the heart, the wastelands of the heart. Because if we're too caught up in building up the self, creating a self, doing stuff for self, there's a way in which it actually separates us from ourselves. There's a distance that gets formed. And if we want to stay close to the heart, we don't want to be too self-centered, too, you know, it's all about me and I have to do it. But to nourish something, to nurture something, to support it to grow, maybe with tremendous effort and sometimes needed, but you're not making it. You're just kind of like, it's a little bit like, I don't know if you will forgive me for saying this, but it's a little bit like Dharma willing. You know, you do your part, and then Dharma willing, something evolves and grows. And what's really great for this Dharma willing thing is the Dharma actually knows better than you what you need. So if you show up on retreat and you know exactly what you're supposed to do, exactly what you need, and you're going to make it happen, and that's usually a recipe for frustration. But if you come here partly to give yourself over for as fully as you can to the retreat, to this, the conditions that are here, and living these conditions, and a little bit trust that if you do that, that something useful, important is going to happen. That's a much more useful approach to being here. You're not measuring and looking for something to happen. And there's not a few people who have come and retreat with some idea, I'm going to work on something. And then a whole different thing happened that they had, could never ever could have imagined was going to happen for them. So this idea of incubating, and one of the primary conditions for a chicken to incubate her eggs is she has to stay present. She has to stay there on those eggs. And so, you know, so one of the primary conditions we're creating here in the retreat is to be present, to be here for our experience, and to hold it close. Imagine like you're here to be present as a nurturing, nourishing movement. You care for yourself. You're loving yourself. You know, you're being, I don't know if this is the right language, but kind of maternal with yourself, since I'm talking about chickens. And so you're gathering together your capacities for attention, for presence, for embodiment, for really experiencing what's happening here. You're gathering together those different capacities for attention that we have, so that you're just here with the experience to hold it tenderly, to be present for it, to allow something to happen, to create the conditions for the incubation to happen. And so that's, you know, so rather than thinking that attention is like this big doing you have to do, and you have to work harder and strain and your mind wanders off, and so you zero back on your breath and you slip off again, and then you chastise yourself and you try again. And what if your approach is, yeah, of course your mind wanders off, but you want to come back in this tender way, this loving way, caring way. If what you want to do is incubate or care for, allow for something that's really precious to unfold. And maybe this idea that you're an egg doesn't work is a nice thing. But what if your heart is your heart is what the similes, the egg and the simile represents. So you're here to be close to your heart, to hold it, to be present for it, to care for it. And so rather than attention, mindfulness being a weapon, being a sledgehammer, being a drill, you know, let's, you know, bore down on the experience, let's really hold on. It's a little bit more like you, something very tender and gentle. Many years ago, I heard a teacher who talked about mindfulness, of holding your experience, whatever you're paying attention to in mindfulness, holding it the way you would pick up a little chick that had fallen from its nest. And you hold it just well enough, kind of in your cupped hand, so it can't fall out, but you don't hold it so much that you hurt it. So it's very tender, holding it. Though apparently it's not a good idea to pick up birds, chicks, because apparently the mother doesn't want it after that, if it has human smell on it. It's just a simile. So, so one of the conditions we're putting in place is attention. But the quality of the attention that you use is actually quite important. And so, do you have any reference point for how to bring a caring, loving, heartfelt attention to your experience? And if you can use that, then it might be more interesting for your mind, more interesting for your heart, to stay present. If your idea of being mindful of the present moment is harsh, you're the commando approach to mindfulness, it might not feel good. You know, it's assertive or aggressive or something. And so the mind probably doesn't want to be present. It doesn't want to be there so much. And so it makes it harder to be present. But to create the conditions, remember, it's all about conditions. What are the conditions that support you to settle, to be here, to allow this incubation to happen? And so some of those things are these paramis, to cultivate these qualities or to call on these qualities. I like to believe that all of us have these qualities in our heart. Some of them have never been developed, but they're there to be called upon. And it begins with generosity. When the Buddha gave what's called a gradual discourse to teach the Dharma to people, and he wanted to do it in a way that inspired them. And inspired them for a particular purpose. To inspire them so their mind, their hearts, became soft, ready, happy, and receptive. Because a happy, soft, ready, receptive mind is a mind that is being well incubated. It's a mind that has the qualities, the conditions to allow something to bloom and to change and to grow. In the Buddha's language, it's that mind is capable of is opening the Dharma eye. So it's a whole different metaphor than I'm using the egg. But the opening the Dharma eye is the first experience of liberation, of freedom. But in order for that liberation to happen, you can't make it happen. You want to make the mind, a kind of mind or the heart, whatever you like to call it, prepared for that. If it's brittle, if it's hard, if it's encased in cement, if it's hiding, your heart's hiding from everything, then, you know, it's not really going to, you know, open the Dharma to eye. It's not really going to hatch. It's not really going to blossom. So the Buddha would give these Dharma talks to inspire people and to kind of change their mind a little bit so they're really receptive. But when he did it, he would start with teachings on generosity and on virtue, on integrity. And we don't have no idea. We don't have any record. There's a list of these things that he gave these talks. And we have no record of what he actually said in these talks. It's such a sad thing, you know, because, you know, he gave a lot of teachings. But there's nothing that matches on this, you know, this clear kind of the sequence of things he says to inspire people. So we have to use our imaginations, perhaps, and have, you know, to be inspired by the idea of generosity, inspired by the idea of ethics. And I'm certainly inspired. What inspires me about generosity, one of the things is I think most healthy societies, the foundation stone of it is generosity. It's hard to imagine a healthy society without just filled with generosity, and you know, the representative of that is the is you know, parents taking care of their kids. I think it's a pretty generous thing. You know, it was only when I became a parent that I realized, what? My parents did this? Really? Wow. Wow. Really? This too they did? Wow. The all night up with a kid, waking up in the middle of the night. It was quite a phenomenal thing. I hope I don't freak you out, but one of the acts of generosity that I did with my son when he was just really small, he was middle of the night, he was sick, was he threw up. And so I put my hands together, like picking up that little chick, you know, bird. I put my hands, cupped my hands together to catch his vomit. It just seemed like the right thing to do, the loving thing to do. I don't know. You know, it seemed like the most natural thing to do. So, I'm weird, or or I like to think of it as it was part of my generosity, my care, you know. And then, you know, and then when I was also, as these kids grew up, I started to, you know, because they were, I didn't really grow up in America much, so there's a lot of this culture that I didn't see. But I was pretty surprised by how many adults volunteered to do all these different things for the kids. You know, it's probably if they had to get paid, it would be like a multi-billion-dollar industry. But it's you know, all these coaches for soccer and for baseball and for, it goes on and on, and music and singing, and there was just all this stuff that there were just adults who, other parents often, who put a tremendous amount of time and effort into supporting kind of a nice childhood experience for the kids of the town. And then to come into the Dharma, which I did as a young man, and be the recipient of people's generosity, was really changed my life. It really inspired me. It really kind of softened something in me. It's there also, you know, I didn't have that much experience of generosity growing up, but to receive it over and over again, the first time it happened, the first little experience where, in my kind of, when I was still a barbarian, that where generosity kind of like made an impression on me. I was working at the San Francisco Zen Center had a bakery called Tassajara Bakery. And I was working there as in the back, kind of I wasn't really a baker, but I was working in the, with the flour and stuff. And, but there was a little office upstairs, and I don't know why I was up in the office, but why I was sitting next to the manager of the bakery. But he'd just opened a letter from some neighborhood association, some neighborhood cause, asking for a donation. I guess they sent it out to all the businesses. And he looked at me and he said, what do you think? Should I give them $50? And I was speechless. And then he did. He wrote a check for them and mailed it off. And I was like, why would you do that? That's how bad it was for me. That how, you know, my, when I had no reference for it. But I was like, wow, why did he do that? And it kind of opened this crack in me. Wow. This is a different way of living and being. And then steadily, you know, it's just like the Dharma world for me was where this world of generosity opened up huge, certainly by being the recipient of it. By the time I went to Asia, I was amazed by the amount of generosity that supports people to practice there. And being in Burma, you know, so many people supported us in so many ways. And it really inspired me because I think it was a healthy way of, at least for me, what it turned out to be a healthy way of thinking was I want to practice harder to be worthy of what they've given me, their support, kind of like for them, I wanted to practice harder. And so it kind of inspired me, yes, let's do this. This is what they're supporting me to do. And one of the wonderful little, all these little drop by drop, you know, there's all these experiences of generosity that changed me, was my first Vipassana retreat in Thailand. Kind of a solo retreat. I was given a little kuti, a little hut on the edge of the monastery, kind of in a swamp kind of place. And there was this hut, on this one room hut on a stilt, had a little porch, had these steps going down towards the swamp. And then there were these wooden planks, like three very long wooden planks, zigzagging to the hard ground. So you had to walk across these planks to get. And since I was not a monastic then, I didn't go with the monastics. They went out to do their alms rounds in the morning and to get food for the monastery and to bring it back. And so I was just meditate. All my meditation was in the little hut. So I was meditating early in the morning, and somehow I got up and I opened the door, and I looked down, and there was an apple and some cookies. And then I kind of looked up across those planks, you know, going away, and there was a monk walking away. So pretty clear that he'd left it there. But given my barbarian background, you know, what was kind of perplexing to me, kind of like mind-opening for me, like he left before I'd ever know he was the one who gave it to me. You know, that he would get thanked or be appreciated or be known as the person giving the gift. He did it completely anonymously. That's, wow, people do that? I was so inspired by that. Wow. You can give without wanting anything in return, just an act of giving. And so it's gone, you know, down through the years and to be in a culture where generosity is the kind of the medium of people meeting each other, relating to each other, caring for each other, is really inspiring. And it continues to inspire me in my practice. It kind of points me to freedom. It points me to the possibility of not being miserly or not being tight or not being closed or not being an island unto myself, you know, just me, myself, and mine. It keeps showing me this, yes, keep opening, yes, keep opening, open the heart, open, be here in this world, in community, with people. So with the paramis, beginning with generosity, and this gradual discourse of the Buddha beginning with generosity, the beginning has to do with our relationships with each other. Generosity generally is done with other people or other beings, with the world. And so it's a way of establishing a healthy relationship. Generosity, I think, done properly, is a healthy thing. It's a healthy relationship that's being developed and formed. And to think of the foundation of Buddhist practice as not being solitary meditation, but the foundation of Buddhist practice is in having healthy relationships with the world. And how's that formed? How do we develop that? How do we explore that? How do we find our way to that? Generosity is one of those ways. And sometimes it's really great to have a practice of generosity where you're generous even when you don't want to. Not that you have to, but to try it. Just push yourself. What's it like? And I found that by doing that, I discovered a lot about why I didn't want to be generous. And that was invaluable. Sometimes it was wise not to be generous, but sometimes it had to do with my inner shenanigans, my inner whatever, foibles, that was good to see and recognize and work through and learn to let go of or learn not to have it run the show and to live a very different life, a freer life. So I think of generosity as a giving. A giving is a releasing. Giving is a freeing of something. And so to give in such a way that it is actually freeing. There's something inside of you gets released and opened up. The Buddha seems to have said that you should only give if it brings you some joy. So and if it's an obligation, it's not giving. But it actually does something good for you. Sometimes the call to be generous that comes maybe from society, religion, family, is such that people give, but it's not generous. Like we feel obligated, I'm supposed to give. But to be generous is a freeing movement. To be generous does change the heart for the better. And so one of the reasons to stay close to the heart is so you can feel the impact of what you do. And you can feel the difference between giving something because you're afraid, or giving something because it's generous, or giving something because it's an exchange. You're hoping to get something in return. The quality, the texture of the heart will be different on each of those motivations. And so to stay close to the heart, to feel what's going on, the heart will become your teacher. The heart will show you what needs to blossom. The heart will, you're helping the heart to have the conditions for it to blossom. So what does it mean to be generous on a retreat? That means it's built into the IRC retreats. Each of you is supporting the retreat. In many ways, you support it by the work meditations you do or the Sangha service you do. You support it by your care with other people, and when it gets kind of crowded in the dining room, and how you maneuver and around that buffet table, and you wait for someone to finish getting their food before you crowd them because you want to get the tofu. You know, you sit back and make room for them. That's generous. It's not generous to look at and say, you know, they're taking too much tofu. How could they? Don't they know there's a lot of people who want tofu? But you sit back and make room for them and let them do their thing. And I mean, there's a very simple act of generosity. Just gives people space. Let them be how they are. And you're generous to the community by doing your practice. If you know, just everyone, I feel it's a tremendous, I feel I receive tremendous gifts from the people I practice with. I'm inspired by them. They model something for me. They kind of encourage a certain kind of intentness or engagement. And like I want to practice when I'm around other people who are practicing. So whether you know you're generous or not, your practice here in the retreat is a gift. I think someone last night said, that, you know, it's hard to practice alone. But here we are, supported by people. And then what does it mean to be generous to yourself on retreat? And here we get to a very interesting issue around retreat practice. Because some people, when you hear the idea of being generous to yourself, will be afraid, now I'm going to be selfish. Like, I'm not supposed to count. I'm supposed to just sacrifice. It's one thing to give to other people. I'm supposed to be the cornucopia for everyone else. But for myself, you know, that's selfish and I don't deserve it. And, you know, it just means that, you know, it's not really generous then. If you stay close to your heart, close to really what you feel in some deep, the equality of your inner life, you feel the difference between being self-centered and being centered on yourself. Being self-centered in a selfish way, being conceited, being arrogant, it's all about me, myself, and mine, all about proving myself how great I am or something or other, is actually a kind of, oddly enough, it's a kind of self-alienation. It's a way of actually losing touch with oneself, with the depth of oneself, the heart of oneself. And if you're really close, staying close to the heart, you'll learn to recognize how that feels off, the suffering of that. But to be centered on yourself is being the chicken with the eggs. We need to, if we really want to allow this deeper stuff to unfold that breaks through selfishness, that really allows for some deeper wellspring of way of being in the world that is not selfish whatsoever, but wells up from the inside out from the heart, we need to have the center of gravity of this practice is the experience in this psychophysical body. Is the and go really here with this, here. Feel the heart, feel oneself, be with what's here. And if what's here is your selfish, that's great if you're in the Dharma, because it's not a problem. It's just something else to hold tenderly. It's just something else to center yourself on. You can trust how it unfolds if you create the right conditions. And if the condition is to keep coming in, don't believe everything that you want to do or think or feel, but hold it gently, hold it caringly, hold it generously. Don't make anything about yourself evil, or don't make anything about yourself wrong or a problem. It's a much, much wiser approach than that, is whatever is in you, whatever is difficult, don't condemn it. Think of it as just one more thing that needs your love. One more thing that needs your care and attention. And if what you notice is that you're selfish, that's what needs your love. And then probably you'll find that something inside will soften and thaw and open, and you'll get a whole different way of being. But if you don't give yourself a chance for that thawing to happen, then that selfishness, that hardness, whatever is there, will stay there and follow you along everywhere. So the idea of being centered on oneself, to take this being that you have, you're sitting in a chair, you're sitting on a cushion, this is the center of the universe for you. Here is the only place where there exists your lived experience. The experience of being alive is not yesterday, it's not tomorrow. The actual experience can only be in the present moment, and it can only be in the location that you are, the very close location, like here in this body and mind. And so to come into your, stay close to your lived experience, but not as a duty, not as a forceful thing, but to really love it or hold it or be curious about it, be interested in it. Kind of like you're a farmer, gardener, who's really nourishing a plant, so that, the seeds, so they can grow and become a plant. You're here, coming back. Yes, yes, come back. Be here. And so to have the, this is the world where it's going to open up. And if you still don't think, you're still worried that this is too self-concerned to be really just here, and you're abandoning your friends and family and society and the world if you're not thinking about them and saving them, this beautiful thing happens if we really, as we go deeper and deeper in the practice, and to trust our hearts, stay close to the heart, is the heart turns itself inside out. Our inside, we turn ourselves inside out. And what I mean by that is that the hardness, the shell that we have, kind of turns inside out, and all the soft part of who we are, the beautiful parts, the love, the care, the generosity, the paramis, kind of begin to be the interface with the world, rather than our skin, or rather than the boundaries we have. And this turning inside out is a phenomenal thing to happen. So to be generous to oneself, to be generous to oneself is to be forgiving. You ever think that forgiving is a generous thing? It involves giving. Giving yourself a break. Giving yourself being generous to yourself. Don't hold yourself, don't weigh yourself down. One of the ways in Buddhism that we forgive is we learn from our past mistakes just enough to think about how we can do better in the future. So we're not weighed down by what we did in the past, but we don't ignore it. We think, oh yeah, I lied to my best friend. That was terrible. How can I not do that again? And so the idea is to be, to generous, is to be forward-looking. How can I be a better person? Not stuck in the past, not weighed down by it. So that's a form of forgiveness. It's being generous to yourself. It's to make space for yourself. And we say, give attention. Is attention an act of generosity? It can be. And generosity is attention is one of the biggest gifts sometimes we can give to ourselves and to other people. I've met a lot of people now as a teacher, and I met a lot of people with a lot of suffering. And that's one of the reasons people come into the Dharma, is to address their suffering in somehow or other. And one of the really deep, difficult sufferings that seems to be, that really kind of goes in deep in people, is people who grow up and no one saw them. To not be seen as a child is almost the same, or is the same, as not being loved. But the idea of seeing, being seen and being known, we need that growing up. We need that to be healthy in society and find our place and feel like we're valued. And so we can still do that to ourselves as adults. There's something about the conditions of meditation, the openness, the quiet, the staying close to the heart, the softness, the readiness that comes with practice, that actually makes the power of our attention really strong. And just hold ourselves with kind attention, hold ourselves with, incubate ourselves, I mean, stay there and really be there. It's kind of like giving ourselves love. It's a phenomenally powerful thing to really hold ourselves and be present. So the parami of generosity, you might think of it as the foundation, the beginning point, certainly is for the paramis. The second parami I'm talking about today is that of virtue and ethics. And there's a lot that can be said on it, and, there's not much time left for this talk. But I wanted to make a really important point. And that is that I think when I was a new Buddhist practitioner, I didn't have any understanding that ethics was important. My initial practice was in Zen, and they didn't really talk about ethics in those years, in the 70s and the 80s. And then when the scandals happened, then they started talking about ethics. They kind of learned that they needed to include it. But it was so bad that, I was ordained as a Zen priest, Zen monk, and you have these precepts, these ethical rules you're supposed to live by. And they're not that many. Depending how you count, there's 10 or 16. So, like in the Theravada tradition, the monastic has 227. So that's a little harder to memorize. But, you only have to learn 10 or 16. So I went to Thailand as a Zen priest, and the abbot there was a little bit perplexed by this Japanese-American, Zen priest. And so he wanted to kind of figure out what to do with me, and he asked me, "What are your precepts?" Couldn't tell him. It was that little emphasized that I couldn't really tell them. I didn't really know. I hadn't really paid attention to it. Should I be embarrassed to tell you that? Probably. But that was the kind of the culture back then. So I'm not the only one at fault. At that retreat where I met that abbot, asked me a question. I did a 10-week Vipassana retreat. So like you're sitting for a week, I sat for 10 weeks. and that kudi on top of the stilts, right, and above the swamp. That was the place. And then after I don't know how many weeks, many weeks, I experienced something new in my chest that I had never experienced before. And it felt, and it was, I used language for myself that I was a little bit aversive to. So I was a little surprised that I was using this language. I used a language of purity. I was experiencing something very clean inside, a feeling of cleanliness and clean. And I could feel as I had that, if I had thoughts that were lustful or not so nice thoughts, kind of a little bit unethical thoughts perhaps, I could feel how that sense of purity or cleanliness or openness that was there got diminished, or sometimes even I used language with like violence done to it. And this feeling felt so good. It made me happy and joyous. And I knew that in Buddhism that people experience joy from their ethical life, but I was kind of perplexed by that, or worse. But then when I started having this feeling, oh, that's what they're talking about. We're talking about a change from the inside out. That is the place out of which being ethical arises. It isn't that ethics is a set of rules you're supposed to follow, which sometimes is a good idea. I don't want to knock that approach. It's possible to incubate yourself, stay close to the heart, and discover from the inside out how good it is to be ethical. That it's not just feel good, it's just, of course I am. Of course I'm not going to harm anyone. Of course I'm not going to act on greed, hate, and delusion. And this idea of greed, hate, and delusion, I worry as a teacher that I, over the years, I've started to use those three words more and more often. And it's, you know, people are probably tuning me out, greed, hate, and delusion. These are really important. And in terms of ethics, it's very interesting. The Buddha said that, or Buddha taught that all unethical behavior arises one way or the other out of the greed, hate, and delusion that people have. Greed, hate, and delusion are kind of umbrella terms for a lot of, you know, variations of those three. So they're pretty inclusive. So all ethical behavior comes out of it. So if we diminish our greed, hate, and delusion, we become more ethical. If we could uproot greed, hate, and delusion, then we become ethical beings, and it becomes a natural thing to be ethical. So that's nice. But really what we want is enlightenment. We want the real stuff. This ethics stuff is kindergarten, is kindergarten Buddhism, you know, and let's get on to this real stuff now. The jhanas and the, you know, different stages of vipassana and the stages of awakening and emptiness would be a good teaching, you know, the really lofty experiences of emptiness. And let's really get into the really juicy, deep practice. My friends, maybe I should apologize or prepare you for this. Diminishing and uprooting greed, hate, and delusion is the deep dharma. The definition, the Buddha's most common way of talking about the destruction of, is talking about awakening, enlightenment, nibbana, is by saying it's the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion. That as people mature in practice, they mature by the lessening of greed, hate, and delusion. So if you want to do, if what you want to do is get enlightened, learn to do this incubation that frees you from greed, hate, and delusion. And then coincidentally, you'll become an ethical person. Isn't that nice? If you don't want to be ethical, but you will be, just like the chicken who doesn't want the eggs to hatch. You don't want it, you know, it's ethics, you know, that's kindergarten stuff. But I want enlightenment. But guess what? You'll become ethical. And some people say, I don't want this enlightenment, this lofty stuff. It's just kind of like world, you know, it's nothing to do with the real world. I just want to live an ethical life. So we work on our greed, hate, and delusion. And when that goes, guess what? You didn't want to be awakened, but you were. I'm saying all this because the path of ethics and the path of liberation are one and the same. That ethics is important at the beginning, the middle, and the end of the path of practice. It's inherent in it. It's one and the same thing. They're not separate from each other. So when the second parami is our ethics, our virtue, our integrity, it's not just about following rules, but it's learning to discover a place inside, in the heart, stay close to your heart, where, of course, you want to be ethical. Of course you want to have integrity. Not because you should, not because it's an obligation, but because it's nourishing. It's nutritious. It's inspiring. It's opening. It brings joy. It brings this feeling of being clean, and it brings beauty here, of course. But some of us are not ethical. And usually the people who are closest to being really ethical, who are most upset about being unethical. Isn't that a strange paradox? It's kind of nice, actually. People, but stay close to the heart. Incubate yourself with the pain you feel, the suffering you feel, the motivations you have. Don't be generous. Don't make anything a problem. Center yourself on your direct experience. Keep coming back. Center yourself here in the body. Center yourself here in the lived experience of the moment, whatever it is. And if it's discomfort, if it's suffering, if it's your heart broken, or ways in which you criticize yourself, hold that gently. Hold it kindly. And what you might learn over time, what I hope you'll learn over time, and it takes its time, maybe it takes years, and that is, at some point, this magic, this wonderful moment happens, or dawns, that holding yourself in kind attention, holding yourself in an awareness which is without greed, hate, and delusion, awareness that just has space for everything, awareness which is not caught by things and not for and against things, that's a treasure. That's one of the most beautiful things. And when we understand that, how important the attention we've been using all along, the attention that's coming in and centering ourselves on ourselves with attention, it's a practice we do over and over again until we discover, wow, this is special. It's almost like that's who I am. And we start identifying more with attention than we identify with all the different stuff that's swirling around inside, ideas we have. So, the paramis, qualities of your heart that's waiting for you. Some of you know them already. Some of them you don't know. They're here to discover them. But you might, as you go through the retreat, especially the next day, since this is was introduced, you might give a quiet, unambitious consideration about how you can maybe bring in some generosity to yourself and to the community, in a way, not because you should, but in a way that supports you to actually be more centered on yourself. It's easy with generosity to lose yourself in the other person, lose yourself in the activity. But how can you be generous to yourself, generous to others, where you're actually the opposite of losing yourself? You're actually more connected. You're more here. And what is it to be more, what is this ethics stuff? What is this integrity stuff? You don't have a lot of opportunities to do a lot of unethical things here in the retreat. But, we still have our thoughts and our things, ideas and unkind speech and things that go on. But what is Gil talking about? What is it? If I kind of come in, stay close to the heart, close to my heart, center myself in the experience here, hold it in the incubator, my experience. How will I find this ethical core in myself that way? How do I awaken this core of purity or cleanliness or openness that has this quality of integrity? Where is that? How do I sit with that? Don't make it a big project. But we're offering you these paramis of the course this week, partly because we want to support your practice here, and partly because it's a really good teachings to take home and live with. And if you, the better you embody or experience or explore generosity and integrity, the more you'll be prepared for renunciation and wisdom. They build on each other. So, sometimes it's nice at the end of a talk to kind of gather yourself back together and kind of put yourself in your meditation posture. And if the talk kind of took you a little bit out of the flow of the practice, maybe it's a nice to kind of put yourself back in the meditation posture so your body remembers.